everyone who loves books. This is Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
I'm Lauren St. John and you're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale, and in this week's show, Lauren St. John tells us how writing for children can literally change minds.
What scientists have found is that books can be a safe space in a way for children to explore difficult issues.
Andrew Beasley introduces us to a Victorian crime-fighting duo with a difference.
He's a wonderful character. He can tell the difference between 27 sorts of tobacco just by the sound of their burning.
With The Book of Dust heading into the RNIB library, I take a look back at Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy.
Lyra and her demon moved through the darkening hall, taking care to keep to one side, out of sight of the kitchen.
And narrator Adjoa Ando tells us about bringing some of the nation's best-loved characters to life.
You go from the beginnings of the detective agency, what caused Ma Ramotswe to have the detective agency in the first place, and then the lives of the people who join her.
That's all coming up on today's Read On Air. Lauren St. John is the best-selling author of several series of books for children and young adults, including the White Giraffe trilogy, the $1 Horse series, and the Laura Marlin mysteries. The fifth Laura Marlin book is out now. The Secret of Supernatural Creek finds the ace teenage detective in the Australian outback, battling to outwit a gang of international criminals. No stranger to excitement herself, Lauren St. John came to the RNIB studios to tell us what inspires her. Lauren St. John, welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, I must admit, I'm really excited. I don't think I have ever interviewed a guest before who had a giraffe as a pet when they were growing up.
You might have met a few with stuffed giraffes, but yes, I'm probably the only one with an actual giraffe.
You had a real live giraffe when you were growing up.
Yes, I was so incredibly fortunate. I was born in Zimbabwe, which was then Rhodesia. And when I was 11, we moved to this amazing farm and game reserve called Rainbow's End. It felt as a child like the end of the rainbow, because I suddenly found myself in this paradise of wild animals. And we had a pet giraffe called Jenny, who was there when we got there. And it was about 60 impala antelopes, wild monkeys, ostriches. And then we had a huge menagerie of ordinary animals as well. I say ordinary, but, you know, beautiful animals like 8 horses, 6 cats, 8 dogs, 2 adopted orphaned warthogs called Miss Piggy and Bacon, which we found funny at that age, and a goat, just simply called Goat, that we got from the RSPCA. So it was an amazing way to grow up. It was just beautiful.
And clearly those very formative experiences have fed into your White Giraffe series of books, which are full of the love and beauty and magic of the natural world and the animals that fill it.
Very much so. I think when I started writing the White Giraffe series, and it wasn't planned. It was literally the idea came to me when I was never, ever thought of being a children's author, mainly because I thought it was an incredibly hard thing to do. But literally one day about 12 years ago, I was walking down the street on my way to do some Christmas shopping. Out of nowhere, an image of a girl on a giraffe came into my head. And I thought, wouldn't it be an amazing thing if you could actually ride a giraffe? And right there on the street, the whole story came into my head. So it wasn't planned, but when it did come into my head, what I most wanted to do is celebrate Africa. Because I think, you know, Africa in the media seems perpetually to get a bad press. You know, it's as if it's nothing but war and disaster and famine. And yes, of course, those things happen and they, you know, they're in many places and it's tragic and we should do as much as we can to help people. But Africa is also full of so much beauty, not just in the landscapes and the animals, but in the people. I mean, there's so many incredible, intelligent, creative, vibrant, amazing people. And I wanted to celebrate that as well.
And certainly that sense of the vibrancy of Africa comes through the books. But you don't shy away from some of the underlying problems of poachers and racism and poverty that trouble Africa. I think what I love about all your books, but especially the White Giraffe books, is that they don't prettify life for the children and young adults who are reading them. They give it in its full spectrum of beauty, wonder, and unpleasantness. Do you find that's an important thing to approach in your writing?
I think it's critical. I mean, this is not why I write, but it's just one aspect of it, which is there's been some really important neurological studies on reading. And, you know, what scientists have found is that books can be a safe space, in a way, for children to explore difficult issues. And I feel like, you know, a lot of head teachers and other people around children now are talking about how what they call snowplow parenting and other ways where children are continually being screened from the real world. And I think it's really, really important to present things as they are, so you grow up with a proper perspective of life. In my latest book, which is called The Snow Angel, which came out on the 5th of October, it's set partly in Kenya and partly in the Highlands of Scotland, and it explores exactly the issues that you've just mentioned, because it's about 11-year-old McKenna, who grows up in a really beautiful, loving and successful home in Nairobi in Kenya. Her father's a mountain guide and she dreams of being a mountaineer herself. Her mother's a science teacher. But when she's orphaned, she finds herself in a very, very difficult situation. And the book is an exploration of what actually makes home, because home can be so many different things to so many people. And it's her trying to find a home. But it definitely doesn't shy away from what I think are so many issues that as the antics of politicians and celebrities have come to dominate the front pages, I think, you know, so often now we just don't want to talk about difficult things, what I think of as the forgotten children of this world, which is what The Snow Angel is about.
And certainly Laura Marlin in the Laura Marlin Mysteries, they are, again, orphaned children, but who learn to trust their own judgment in an adult world of some bad people, some good people, but through interaction with the natural world rather than a cyber world.
Very much so, because I think, you know, I grew up before the internet and we didn't even have a television until I was about 15. And well, it's so important for children in general. It's important for the mental health, apart from anything else. I think to be in nature is such a healing thing. And it also, it's so beautiful. And I'm passionate about it. So I've always wanted to try and connect children to nature and what I think of as their future, which is teaching them to preserve the environment and animals so that they've got a future to look forward to. Because, you know, frankly, our generation hasn't done a great job of stewarding our planet.
And an awful lot of the knowledge of how to steward the planet, how not to exhaust its resources, is being forgotten. I found myself fascinated by learning a bit of bushcraft through the White Giraffe series and talking to my two children when they were reading the books about skills that man has possessed for thousands of years and that could disappear in a generation.
Absolutely. I mean, when I was growing up, I was absolutely fascinated with survival skills. I've always been the sort of person, I actually never travel without a very well-equipped survival kit. I went to Rwanda earlier this year with Save the Children, and I took my survival kit. I actually never travel without it. But I love learning survival skills, and now it's fun because actually you can watch these really incredible things on YouTube and go and try them out yourself. But I think when I went to boarding school when I was 8 and until I was 16, which I actually really enjoyed, you know, in Zimbabwe. I had a lot of friends and I really enjoyed it. But I think it taught me a kind of independence and resourcefulness, which I find as an adult has really stood me in good stead. And so I think that may be some of why I think that I give the children my books so much independence to think for themselves.
Now, your books are classified for children and young adults. I know we were having a conversation before we came into the studio about how the young adult genre is the most exciting of all the areas of publishing at the moment. It allows authors and readers to tackle a range of issues that a lot of literary fiction doesn't necessarily want to come to grips with. What was it that attracted you to writing for children and young adults?
Once I started writing the White Giraffe series, when I was growing up, you know, conservation was taught in schools, for instance, and that was a huge part of it was something so important to me growing up that when I started writing the series, I thought, this is so amazing, I can try and foster in children a love of animals and nature, but also teach them the critical issues that are facing animals today. And it's such an exciting genre to be in, writing children's fiction, because I think children's authors now are tackling some of the most challenging and important issues of our time. But I don't feel that certainly among the children's authors I know, people are not attracted to issues for the sake of ticking boxes. Everyone I know, whether it's somebody like Jill Lewis, who's just written in her new novel Skydancer about the plight of hen harriers, Robert McFarlane, and the illustrator Jackie Morris, they've just done an amazing book called The Lost Words. There's so many people writing really passionately about things that they believe should be changed or explored in our world. So I don't think people tick boxes. I think it comes from a real passionate place of wanting to make a better world.
And I wonder if part of that is also that in the young adult sector, you can introduce magical realism. You can step outside the daily experience of the reader, because children will suspend their disbelief more readily, and look at some of the issues that surround us from a slightly different angle, whereas more adult literary fiction tends to dwell on the author's reaction or the protagonist's reaction to what's happening to them.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. I think what's great now is that all children's fiction, whether it's middle grade and YA, understandably are the categories that booksellers have to put things in, just simply to help parents and children if they're going in to choose books. But for me, whether I'm writing Laura Marlin, The Secret of Supernatural Creek, which is a kind of more obviously middle grade, that is to say 9 to 12 sort of audience, or whether I'm writing something like The Snow Angel, which for me is a book which hopefully will be read by anyone from 9 to 90. Speaking for myself, I try to just tell stories. So I love it. I find it quite funny because often parents will come up to me in the audience when I'm signing books and sort of say, you know, I sort of read my daughter's book as well. And you know, I'm a bit embarrassed, you know, it's a children's book, but, you know, I really love your books. And for me, that's such a massive compliment. I just tell stories. I want my books to be read by anybody from 90, 80, 50, of all gender. I just want people to enjoy my books.
A wonderful thing that you might not know about your books is that when I went to the RNIB Talking Books Library, I found that almost all of them are available there. So you have tens of thousands of visually impaired people who are enjoying your books, and we probably do span the age of 9 to 90. They're very popular amongst the visually impaired community, and they're all there. Is your commitment to audiobooks something that you feel strongly about?
Very. You know, I mean, that is such a wonderful thing that you've just said, and it's actually very moving, actually. Thank you for saying it. It's actually made my day.
Something else that might make your day is I was interviewing one of the narrators called Adjoa Ando, who...
Yes.
The voice of the White Giraffe series.
Wow, that's amazing.
And she just said that she thought your books were absolutely wonderful, how much she'd enjoyed reading them, and how they, unlike some other books she's read, do reflect the Africa that she knows.
Oh, that's so wonderful to hear. That's really, really nice. Actually, the audio reader of The Snow Angel is Gillian Burke, who's the countryside presenter. But she actually grew up at the foot of Mount Kenya, where a lot of the book is set. And like the protagonist, McKenna dreamed of climbing Mount Kenya. So that was really, really wonderful to hear as well. Just going back to the audio books, the other place where they find their way is in lots of parts of Africa. Either books are difficult to get or incredibly heavily taxed. I mean, for instance, in South Africa, books are really, really expensive. And a lot of people read listen to audiobooks or read them on read books on Kindle. And it's nice to be able to get into other areas through audiobooks that you can't necessarily get with a conventional book.
One of the great pleasures of this job is meeting authors who are committed to making sure that people with any form of disability, but especially blindness, do have access to reading material. Because, especially for those of us who have lost our sight, it is actually a lifeline back to a happier past.
Well, that's beautiful to hear. I mean, for me, when I write as well, and I hope this is something that visually impaired people might appreciate, is I see books in a very, I suppose, visual in the sense of I want to evoke images in people's minds. Years ago, I spent 10 years as a sports writer for the Sunday Times as a golf correspondent. And I also spent a lot of time writing about music and travelling around America on the tour buses of people like Emmylou Harris and Linda Ronstadt and the Dixie Chicks. And that was heavenly. And Steve Earle as well. But I'd find myself in these amazing situations, like standing backstage at the Greek Theatre in LA, watching Steve Earle and Mary Chapin Carpenter, or on the 18th green with Tiger Woods at the Masters. And the one thing I always wanted to do, because I think this is the role of certainly a journalist, but really any writer, is make people feel as if they're actually there, so they can sort of live the experience as well. And I try very, very hard to do that in my writing.
Well, you certainly succeed. I thoroughly enjoy reading your books, even after my children have got past the age of needing to have them read to them. I still happily return to your books.
That's lovely.
Thoroughly looking forward to the new Laura Marlin book, The Secret of Supernatural Creek, which I suspect will be joining its fellows in the RNIB Talking Books Library soon. Lauren St. John, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On Air.
Thank you so much. It's been really a pleasure to be here.
People like to say that things come in threes, but the way Martine looked at it, that all depends on when you start counting and when you stop. For instance, she could say that one bad thing happened along with three good things, but the truth was that the one bad thing was the very worst thing in the whole world. Another was so small she didn't really notice it at the time. And something else that she first thought was bad luck later turned out to be the best kind of fortune anyone could wish for. Whichever way you added it up, though, one thing was certain. The night Martine Allen turned 11 years old was the night her life changed absolutely, totally and completely, and was never the same again.
The White Giraffe, written by my guest Lauren St. John and narrated by Adjoa Ando, of whom more later. Thanks to Lauren St. John. Many of her wonderful books for children and young adults are available from the RNIB Library in a range of formats, including The White Giraffe, which is TB16278, and Kentucky Thriller, which is TB21574.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Talking books are wonderful. They enable people who can't read anymore to join in with the rest of the world and be a part of the world. I think they're excellent. I enjoy biography, I enjoy travel, I enjoy classics, I enjoy a good tale. With some of the readers, there is a problem that you can go to sleep in the middle when you get to my age.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come on this week's show, the voice of the number one ladies detective agency, and we take a listen to the talking book versions of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. But first, Andrew Beasley is a children's author whose trilogy, The Battles of Ben Kingdom, are set in Victorian London. Ben is a street urchin who alone can save the world from the forces of evil. And Andrew Beasley has returned to Victorian times for his new series of Victorian detective stories, Scream, or S-C-R-E-A-M. The first two books, The Mummy's Revenge and Carnival of Monsters, are now out in paperback. And, as you'll hear, when I interviewed Andrew, it was break time at the school where he works as a teacher. I began by asking him what the acronym SCREAM stands for.
SCREAM, my son helped me with it, in fact. I've got a lovely boy, 11 years old. He helped me. It's Supernatural Crimes, Rescues, Emergencies and Mysteries. And it's the adventures of these two young detectives in a special branch of the police force.
They come from opposite sides of the tracks.
They absolutely do, yes. Billy Flint comes from a family of villains. Even his grandma, for goodness sake, is an armed robber. But he's the black sheep of the family because, first of all, he didn't want to be a pickpocket or a thief or an arsonist or a safe breaker. He went into the church because he's got this special gift. And if that wasn't bad enough, he then becomes a copper. So they absolutely refuse to talk about him. And occasionally in the stories, they bump into one of his dubious cousins or some distant relative who's up to no good.
This dubious gift that he has is a sixth sense for the supernatural.
Exactly, yes. He can sense the presence of the supernatural, which is quite a useful skill if you happen to be a supernatural detective. It does give you a bit of a head start, doesn't it?
And his sidekick is a rather charming, witty, intelligent young woman.
She certainly is. Well, not even psychic, they're partners. And Charlotte, or Charlie Steele, is one of my favourite characters ever. I absolutely love her. As you say, they're opposite sides of the spectrum. She comes from quite a moneyed background, but instead of living up to the expectations of the age and just doing needlework or playing the piano and waiting to get married, she's got this incredible scientific mind. And so she brings sort of cutting-edge Victorian crime scene investigation to the series. So she can tell the difference between a yeti hair and a werewolf hair and that sort of thing. And she can solve crimes that way. She's rather lovely. I'm very, very fond of Charlie.
Well, certainly my teenage daughter took to her immediately. And it seems almost incidental that Charlie is in a wheelchair.
That's right. That's one of the things that I was very, very keen on. Before I write any part of the story, I just create the characters. I do the whole of their life, so I know their hopes and fears and dreams and all those sort of things. And when I was writing Charlie, I discovered that she had polio as a child, and she was therefore in a wheelchair. And this is something which was just Charlie. But I had conversations with my editor and other such people, and I said, look, are you sure about this? Can we not just change it? Charlie is. And they said, well, you're making it quite difficult for yourself. I said, well, that's not a reason not to write. You know, I'm a writer. I don't mind being challenged. And they said, well, you know, you've got to make sure that you do it carefully, do it sensitively. And I hope, you know, from some of the feedback I've had from people is that's something I've been able to do, which is quite exciting.
Well, I think she's a very positive role model. She doesn't let her wheelchair define her. She is, in fact, in some cases, she uses it to help her, doesn't she? Thinking especially of the rather unpleasant character who uses some rather unpleasant language to describe her, and she runs over his foot.
She does indeed. Quite right too. If it wasn't revealed on the cover, and actually I'm incredibly proud that it is, I don't think you'd actually know that Charlie was a wheelchair user until the scene where they get off the train. Because, you know, as we said at the start, you know, it is just who she is. I mean, she's this amazing, witty, brilliant, funny, clever girl. And she just happens to have this extra obstacle to overcome.
And in part, I believe you're writing from experience. Didn't you have an accident when you were a young man?
Well, you say young man. I was 28 years old, and I did something really... I know, it's terrible. And I was jumping over a fence while singing the Mission Impossible theme. And this is all true. And I really smashed myself up. I had a spiral fracture of my elbow... But when I went to have the sort of metal plates put in my arm, and I woke up on the operating table, and I was actually paralysed. They'd crushed my radial nerve. I didn't even know I had a radial nerve, but they'd crushed it. And so I spent the morning being a silly beggar, and then I woke up in the evening being someone who was no longer able to do up my shirt buttons, or drive home in my car, or cut up my dinner. So yeah, it's not the same as being in a wheelchair, but it is an experience of being me, of having the same aspirations and hopes and dreams, and same sense of humour, but just, as I say, having that extra obstacle in my life.
Well, clearly it's fed into your writing, and clearly you've produced a very strong role model for children to look at and realise that the wheelchair is not the person. Any hope that you might do the same for a blind character in the future?
Well, actually, in my previous series, The Battles of Ben Kingdom, one of my favourite characters there is the mentor. And he is my interpretation of Sherlock Holmes. If Sherlock Holmes was middle-aged, grumpy, barrel-chested, shaven-headed, played by Ray Winston, hopefully, and blind... And he's a wonderful character. He can tell the difference between 27 sorts of tobacco just by the sound of their burning. He can hear a spider crawling up the wall by the drumming of its legs. And I have huge, huge fun with him. He's just a wonderful character.
Now, that series is also set in Victorian England, yes, amongst street urchins. Did you like the street boys in the Sherlock Holmes books? Where's the fascination come from?
Yeah, you have me there. It's Sherlock Holmes. I mean, there's just something... fabulous about those detective stories, and the cobbled streets and the swirling mist and villains with big moustaches. And but also as a writer, it's an interesting age to set stories in, because it can be a mirror to today, with parallels between the rich and the poor and industrialization and all those sort of things. But it's a really rich environment. I just love it.
And it's certainly a rich theme to mine, the absence of mobile phones and the use of people actually having to use their minds to work out problems must be something that chimes with you as a primary school teacher. You must wish that your children did a bit more of that and a little bit less Googling search.
But you know what? It's wonderful working with children. I mean, they are continually inspirational, exciting. You know, their imaginations are phenomenal. And as I hinted at before, actually... I say test my books on my own two children, but they do read things before I send them to my editors or my publisher, and they say if that doesn't make sense or how do they work that out. And as I hinted before, Ben had spotted that I originally called the group obviously Scream, but I had it Supernatural Crimes and Mysteries, and he said, Dad, that doesn't work. That's a rubbish acronym. You've got to change it. So it is wonderful having kids to help me, and they prod the story, and they will tell you if it doesn't make sense. And sometimes as a writer, you know, you're so wrapped up in it, you think it's obvious. But they can say, no, actually, Dad, that doesn't work.
Are your pupils at school very supportive of your writing?
It's a real thrill to be able to see your books in the library. And, I've been very, very fortunate that a number of books have been taken up as school readers. And And so I have a wonderful ongoing dialogue with not just the kids in my school, but lots of other schools across the country.
And does the national curriculum address disability awareness much, or are you finding that the characters that you're writing in your books are opening the eyes of children to people's potential if they do have disabilities?
Within the national curriculum, it's sort of covered within what we now call PSDD, personal, social, and moral education. One of the wonderful things about children is that they very rarely see disability, certainly at a young age. And at the moment, I'm working with 4, 5, and 6 year olds in my school, and they just see the child, they just see their friend. They don't see colour, they don't see the sex, they don't see anything. They go, oh yeah, that's just Jojo, that's just Sam. I think it's as we get a bit older that we start to put limitations and imaginary barriers on people. But children are continually hopeful. But it's been fascinating to me that what certainly wasn't the main purpose of the book, it's not an issues book at all, it's an adventure book, has become one of the things that I'm really, really talking about. I've been contacted by Paralympians and some other wonderful people who have said, look, it is so delightful to see a character who represents me on the cover of a mainstream book. So I've been, my eyes have been opened about to that, I think.
Well, I think it's a wonderful message. I think it's, it's very positive. Certainly something that chimed with both my teenage kids. And, as we all know, teenagers can be quite cynical about these things, but they just went, that's brilliant. So you must also be delighted that your books are being made into audiobooks and are available in giant print from the RNIB library.
Yes.
Literacy must be very close to your heart.
I think you don't become a teacher and you don't become a writer if you're not just simply in love with books. Basically all my life, since I've been able to stand up, my mum says my first words were, read a book. And I've been carrying a book ever since. I don't always get time to read it now, but I have to have a book with me. And, as a teacher and as a dad, just imparting that gift, because it's not just, the key to opening up education. It's a lifelong pleasure. I want to give the kids, the same chance to just really have fun, to meet extraordinary characters, to go places they may never go, to encounter ideologies that may maybe conflict with theirs, but just to sort of meet with these people, journey to these places. Books are just incredible. Yeah, I've given my life to books, really. I am a huge fan of audiobooks, and in fact, I'm very fortunate that my son has just started secondary school, and we have a 45-minute drive in the mornings together. And every day, we've chosen our story, and that's what we listen to. We don't have music on in the car. We have a story, and indeed, when Daddy is too tired to read at home, we put on a story CD there as well for my son and my daughter. So, yeah, I love the spoken word. It's amazing.
Have you listened to the Ben Kingdom books yourself?
I have, yes. And it's fascinating because he does different accents to the accents that I do when I'm doing it. So that's like, I like it, but I don't do that voice. I do a different voice there.
Any hope that you might read the Scream books yourself, or are you going to go to a narrator instead?
If I was given the opportunity, I think I would absolutely love it. And in fact, the Scream books have just been put up for an award in Somerset, which is in the read aloud category, as books that are just really nice to read aloud at a class. So if the phone rings, I shall say yes, please, especially if I can get the time off school.
Oh, well, let's hope the publishers are listening. Andrew Beasley, thank you so much for talking about the Scream books and also about the Ben Kingdom books.
Thank you so very much.
Thanks to Andrew Beasley. The first two books in the Scream series are out now in paperback, and the first two volumes of The Battles of Ben Kingdom, The Claws of Evil and The Fear of Ravens are available as TB21693 and TB21694, respectively.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
RNIB Talking Books have had the privilege of working with some great authors who come into the studio to record their own work. Roald Dahl is known for tales such as The BFG, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Matilda and James and the Giant Peach. And it was the latter of these stories that Roald Dahl came into the Talking Book Studios to record back in 1986.
James Henry Trotter stood there clutching the bag and staring at the old man. And now, the old man said, all you've got to do is this. Take a large jug of water and pour all the little green things into it. Then very slowly, one by one, add 10 hairs from your own head. That sets them off. It gets them going. In a couple of minutes, the water will begin to froth and bubble furiously. And as soon as that happens, you must quickly drink it all down, the whole jugful in one gulp.
Roald Dahl reading James and the Giant Peach back in 1986. For more information on this and other celebrity narrators, head to the Talking Book pages of www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up soon, a sneak preview of Philip Pullman's new novel, La Belle Sauvage, narrated by Michael Sheen. But before that, Adjoa Ando is a star of stage, screen, radio and audiobooks. Listeners may know her best as the voice of the number one ladies detective agency. I caught up with Adjoa Ando as she took a break from recording at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'll start off with the number one ladies detective series. Mm-hmm. They sound like great fun to record.
What's interesting about them is they give you a sort of a gentle snapshot into one perspective on Africa. They're gentle books. I think gentle is the word that comes to mind when I think about them. You know, they talk about difficult subjects in a gentle way, and they use Africa as a great backdrop for gentle detective stories with fun characters that you sort of come to know and love as the series develops. And what's great about them is you go from the beginnings of the detective agency, what caused Mara Motswe to have the detective agency in the first place, and then the lives of the people who join her. So you know, Mama Kutsi, and then Mara Motswe's Mr. Jelbi Matekone, her husband, who has the garage next door, and Futi Radifuti, who marries Mama Kutsi. So who owns a furniture shop. So you start to get this. He starts the building blocks of the world, Alexander McCall Smith, and then things come in and out of the world. And the actual detection is only part of the joy of the stories. You just see people develop and grow and have kids and grow up and fall in and out of relationships and friendships and have a sense of the world that they inhabit on a day-to-day basis as well.
Rather like a soap opera.
Yes, yeah, you could say they're sort of a gentle extended soap on the page or, you know, in the audio. Yeah.
I know you've also narrated several more hard-hitting books to do with Africa and the history of slavery. Have any of those really stuck in your mind when you've read them?
Well, I've done a whole heap of, I mean, I must have done over 100, in the hundreds now, of audio books. And given that I've got a Ghanaian father and an English mother, a selection of them have been set in Africa, which I love. There's a writer called Aminata Fauna who wrote a book called The Devil Who Danced on the Water, and another book called Ancestor Stones, which are about growing up in Sierra Leone with her father as the finance minister in the first post-independent government. I love her. Her mother was Scottish, her father Sierra Leone. Ancestor Stones is about the lives of four of her aunts, and she does it in a historic way. So she goes back to the founding of the village that her family grew up in. So you get a history of the tribes and the culture of Sierra Leone. But you get these fabulous stories about women who fall in love, women who never marry, women who deal with mental health issues. They are in Sierra Leone. Some of them travel to England. Some of them become business women and travel all over the world. You hear all sorts of things. So you get a history of her family through these four women's stories, and you get a history of the country as well. So it's sort of rather brilliant. And then The Devil Who Danced on Water is about what it was like being a little girl in this country as her father became the finance minister with her Scottish mother, and then the civil war that happens in the country and the fear. And her father is, it's not a spoiler alert, he's a historical figure. Then her father is hung. So it's the book is the first 10 years of her life and the last 10 years of his and what happens to them. It's the terrifically moving writing. So those aren't fictional, they're factual books, but really wonderful. So she's a great favourite. Then you get slavery, so you get Africa from another perspective when you look at some of the works that are set in America. interestingly, I'm here at the moment. We've bumped into each other because I'm recording some science fiction stuff here. There's a fantastic writer called Octavia E. Butler. She was writing science fiction from the 50s onwards. Black woman, extraordinary woman. And I suppose her most popular book is a book called Kindred, which came out in the 70s, which I haven't actually recorded. But it's... Well, I'd love to record it. Maybe I'm putting a little pitch. I'll record Octavia E. Butler's Kindred, anybody. But that tells the story of a woman who, through a sort of time warp in the fabric of, I don't know, whatever it is that we live in, gets flung back into slavery as a black woman. And she doesn't know when it's going to happen. So she can be sitting at her desk writing in America and suddenly she's sucked back through this time vortex and she's a slave. And when she's a slave, that experience can last for months. And she's experiencing slavery like somebody from our era would experience it, with all the horror and the misunderstanding about what you're allowed to do and not allowed to do and all of that sort of stuff. And then she gets flung back into her contemporary life and then it goes backwards and forwards. And that book gave me a real chilling sense of what it is like to suddenly have no power or no agency or control over what happens to you. So there's a real range of work out there.
I first came across you when I was reading one of the Anne Leckie books.
Ah, yes.
Another sci-fi writer.
The great Anne Leckie.
And I believe you've read all her books to date.
I think you? I have, yes.
The Imperial Raj series.
Yep. What's so great about science fiction work when it's extremely well written and thought through is it becomes a space in which you can talk about our society but not have to be limited by the limits of our society. You can talk about what's possible. You can talk about morality. You can go to extraordinary worlds and have these amazing vistas and senses of what the parameters are that are just free of the limits of our parameters. There's another writer called Alistair Reynolds who is also extraordinary at doing that. And he's a physicist. And I remember reading one of his books where one scene, there is a woman whose family heritage is East Africa, who were very close with elephants. And East Africa had become the place where all space study was happening. She is living on a new planet that humans have gone to try to repopulate. And she gets dragged off into intergalactic AI wars. So she's talking to an artificial intelligence, which is manifest as an 8-year-old Chinese girl, but actually is an artificial intelligence that goes right across the universe. And they're talking to another intelligence, a massive female whale. So you've got this East African woman, the small Chinese girl who is really an AI, and a massive talking female whale. All having a conversation about science and what is going to happen to all the different planets. It's just these moments of bliss. And what you also have is you have three female characters not talking about blokes, which is bliss.
I was going to ask you, when you are clearly so busy, you've been a lead actor at the National, the RSC, you've had long-running parts in Casualty, EastEnders, Doctor Who, where you were Martha's mum,
mm-hmm.
MI High, which was my children's favourite programme for
hooray.
A very long time. You are the boss.
I am, yes.
I was going to ask you why you kept coming back to talking books, and I think you've actually answered the question already. You clearly love it.
I do. I love well-written material, and it doesn't really matter what medium. My father, as I say, is from Ghana, and I you know, he listened to the World Service, and I grew up listening to radio. I love storytelling. I love listening to stories. But also, specifically to the RNIB, I had an uncle who was a great sportsman. He played rugby for England in the 70s and a very physical person who got cancer. And one of the ways it manifested was that he had a tumour that pressed onto his optical nerves and he went blind. So he would listen to a lot of talking books. He would listen to a lot of storytelling. He would make me read things to him. And I really, really began to value the work in that way. Just that opening out of the storytelling, you know, the opening out of the literature. So I like listening to stories, and I enjoy sharing that with other people. So, you know, I have a particular fondness for the work that RNIB does in that way. Literature should be accessible to everybody, and if I can join in with that, then I'm very happy to. Also, I'm gainfully employed doing something I love. What's not to like about that?
Indeed, and you have a beautiful voice that brings an awful lot of pleasure to those of us who can't actually read the physical copies of books anymore. I'm thoroughly looking forward to a weekend of sitting down and reading the White Giraffe series, because I'm interviewing its author, Lauren St. John.
Oh, yes, the White Giraffe series.
So,
they were great. Those books were great. They were so great. She has a real skill at, you know, books that are ostensibly aimed at, I don't know, young teen readers, perhaps. But they work. They just work brilliantly for everybody. I found them incredibly moving and engaging, those stories. Great central characters, plucky teenagers having to cope with really difficult and sad and frightening things in their life and finding ways to navigate their way through the world. So, you know, stories that are very exciting but also full of great encouragement.
I do think that the young adult sector of publishing is probably the most exciting at the moment. Gone are the days where we protect children from the fact that people do die and people can be unfair and do get bullied. And yet there's that magical realism that operates in a teenage mind that just flows off the page. It's exciting.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, what's communicating, what's literature, what's storytelling for? I think it's what I call it, it's a heart-to-heart resonance. It's about being able to share experiences. It's about sharing experiences that may not be familiar in the detail of them. But, you know, we all go through the same things in different circumstances and in different ways. And to be able to explore how one copes with different situations and how one triumphs or fails within them and comes to some sort of way of being able to move forward is really important. And that's what's so exciting about stories. You can go anywhere you like with them, really, and that's great. So I think that way of not shielding youngsters from trickiness is just honest, because it's not like they're not experiencing it. Let them read about it, hear about it, share other people's experiences and see and reflect on how they're managing their own.
Yeah, and develop their empathy.
Absolutely. Empathy, coping skills, permission to know it's all right to feel terrible about something and to feel like a failure or a disaster area, and to know that that's not the end of your life.
It's strange. You hear stories about ancillaries, and it seems like the most awful thing, the most viscerally appalling thing the Ratchai have done. To invade and take, what, half the adult population? And turn them into walking corpses, slave to your ships, AIs? Turned against their own people? If you'd asked me before you annexed us, I'd have said it was a fate worse than death. She turned to me. Is it? None of my bodies is dead, Divine, I said. And your estimate of the typical percentage of annexed populations who were made into ancillaries is excessive. You used to horrify me, said the head priest to me. The very thought of you near was terrifying. Your dead faces, those expressionless voices. But today, I am more horrified at the thought of a unit of living human beings who serve voluntarily, because I don't think I could trust them.
My guest, Adjoa Ando, reading Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, which is TB21614. My thanks to Adjoa Ando, and you can find a full list of the books that she has narrated by going to the RNIB Library website at rniblibrary.com. Do you have a favourite narrator, or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. That's readonair, all one word, @rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Philip Pullman is a hugely successful author of books for children and young adults that are enjoyed by people of all ages around the world. Many of his books are available in a range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including his best-known work. His Dark Materials is a trilogy set across parallel worlds. Its teenage hero, Lyra, must follow her destiny in a quest to discover the nature of dust, cosmic particles that fall to Earth and lie at the heart of religious belief in Lyra's world. The first book, Northern Lights, was published in 1995. It won not only that year's Carnegie Medal, which recognises the best fiction for children and young adults, but it was also voted the Carnegie of Carnegies in 2007 when the prize celebrated its 70th anniversary.
Lyra and her demon moved through the darkening hall, taking care to keep to one side, out of sight of the kitchen. The three great tables that ran the length of the hall were laid already, the silver and the glass catching what little light there was, and the long benches were pulled out, ready for the guests. Portraits of former masters hung high up in the gloom along the walls. Lyra reached the dice and looked back at the open kitchen door, and, seeing no one, stepped up beside the high table. The places here were laid with gold, not silver, and the 14 seats were not oak benches, but mahogany chairs with velvet cushions. Lyra stopped beside the master's chair and flicked the biggest glass gently with a fingernail. The sound rang clearly through the hall.
"You're not taking this seriously," whispered her demon. "Behave yourself."
A clip of Northern Lights narrated by David Thorpe, who read all three volumes of His Dark Materials for the RNIB Library. Whereas the first book is set in a parallel steampunk version of our world, the second, The Subtle Knife, moves between three parallel worlds, including our own. And the third book, The Amber Spyglass, takes Lyra and her companions into multiple versions.
"Be quiet," said Will. "Just be quiet. Don't disturb me."
It was just after Lyra had been taken, just after Will had come down from the mountaintop, just after the witch had killed his father. Will lit the little tin lantern he had taken from his father's pack using the dry matches that he had found with it, and crouched in the lee of the rock to open Lyra's rucksack. He felt inside with his good hand and found the heavy, velvet-wrapped alethiometer. It glittered in the lantern light, and he held it out to the two shapes that stood beside him, the shapes who called themselves angels. "Can you read this?" he said.
"No," said a voice. "Come with us. You must come. Come now to Lord Asriel."
"Who made you follow my father? You said he didn't know you were following him, but he did," Will said fiercely. "He told me to expect you. He knew more than you thought. Who sent you?"
"No one sent us. Ourselves only," came the voice. "We want to serve Lord Asriel, and the dead man... What did he want you to do with the knife?"
Will had to hesitate.
"He said I should take it to Lord Asriel," he said.
"Then come with us."
"No, not till I've found Lyra."
David Thorpe narrating The Amber Spyglass, the third book in Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials series, which was published in 2000. Now, 17 years on, Philip Pullman is back with a new trilogy, The Book of Dust. The first volume, La Belle Sauvage, is a prequel to Northern Lights, revealing how Lyra came to grow up in an Oxford college. The audiobook version is read by Michael Sheen and will be available from the RNIB library soon. In the meantime, though, courtesy of Penguin Random House, here's a taste.
3 miles up the River Thames from the centre of Oxford, some distance from where the great colleges of Jordan, Gabriel, Balliol, and 24 others contended for mastery in the boat races, out where the city was only a collection of towers and spires in the distance over the misty levels of Port Meadow, there stood the Priory of Godstow. where the gentle nuns went about their holy business. And on the opposite bank from the priory, there was an inn called The Trout. The inn was an old stone-built, rambling, comfortable sort of place. There was a terrace above the river, where peacocks, one called Norman and the other called Barry, stalked among the drinkers, helping themselves to snacks without the slightest hesitation, and occasionally lifting their heads to utter ferocious and meaningless screams. There was a saloon bar, where the gentry, if college scholars count as gentry, took their ale and smoked their pipes. There was a public bar, where watermen and farm labourers sat by the fire or played darts, or stood at the bar gossiping or arguing, or simply getting quietly drunk. There was a kitchen, where the landlord's wife cooked a great joint every day, with a complicated arrangement of wheels and chains turning a spit over an open fire. And there was a potboy, called Malcolm Polstead. Malcolm was the landlord's son, an only child. He was 11 years old, with an inquisitive, kindly disposition, a stocky build, and ginger hair. He went to Ulvercott Elementary School, a mile away, and he had friends enough, but he was happiest on his own, playing with his demon, Aster, in their canoe, which was called La Belle Sauvage. A witty acquaintance thought it amusing to scrawl an S over the V, and Malcolm patiently painted it out 3 times before losing his temper and knocking the fool into the water, at which point they declared a truce.
Michael Sheen reading from La Belle Sauvage, the first book in Philip Pullman's new Book of Dust trilogy. And if you want more information about accessible versions of Philip Pullman's books, you can contact the RNIB Library at rniblibrary.com or by ringing the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch about your book groups, the titles you're reading, and suggestions for books that might broaden my horizons. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You can find a link at our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or just search for RNIB Radio. So, farewell until next week, and remember to read on.